Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Boris Hossein. I'll be with you for the next half hour. Well, we seem to be talking about housing quite a bit across the country, and today's show will be no exception. Good news couldn't come too soon for those who wait. The Revelstoke Community Housing Society just received a $100,000 grant for its fourth housing project in 10 years.
Amazing. Wonderful. Thrilled. We had an idea it was money, but we didn't know the amount until we were in there.
The Amateur Quadra Island out west is going big this spring. It will be producing Chicago the Musical. Over 70 people are involved. Dancers, musicians, producers, and backstage personnel with different levels of experience take on the challenge.
It's amateur theater. It's a small community. We try and engage people in stepping out into some of the smaller roles. And we have a very talented, it's just really such a great community that gets involved.
And after being shown in Washington, D.C. and across Canada, the Red Dress Art Project and exhibit will be featured at Queen's University campus just ahead of the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Gender Diverse People.
Red represents the lifeblood that we all carry, so it's this interconnection between us all. And using the color red as well is sort of showing the violence of not caring for that lifeblood and that sacred lifeblood that we all carry.
Welcome to Viewpoints.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Thanks for being with us. The Revelstoke Housing Society just received great news. The city of Revelstoke sent a $100,000 grant their way. The grant, which came as a surprise to the Housing Society, was handed to them at the beginning of April to go towards development plans for the Society's next affordable housing complex. Operations manager Kira Wolf and Michael Brooks Hill, a co-chair of the Society, says it costs money to get a proposal ready to request money for a housing development. Getting this grant up front will hopefully expedite the project. The Housing Society is hoping to build on land adjacent to a build they already completed. More than 20 units will be constructed. It's not their first project. Over the years, the Housing Society has developed three housing complexes. They were completed in 2010, 2016, and 2022. Here's Megan Dooling in Revelstoke, BC.
Amazing. Wonderful. Thrilled.
That's how Kira Wolf felt when she found out the city of Revelstoke was giving the Revelstoke Community Housing Society $100,000.
We were given 2 days' notice. We were summoned that something was going to happen, and we had an idea it was money, but we didn't know the amount until we were in there.
The executive director of the Housing Society says the money is going towards development costs for a new affordable housing project.
We're paying for an entire architecture plan for a new build. We're doing a site survey, economic survey. We have a site evaluation. We're doing a cost analysis. And this will also pay for the application that is going to the funding partner. BC Housing or any of our funding partners, they won't give us a blank check. We need to come to them with a plan to build a house. Same thing for the city. If they're going to lease us land, they need a plan. They need to see what we're going to do with those, with that piece of land. So we have partnered with Altus, and we've created a new build. It's going that we're hopefully going to be able to expedite and get funding for, but that all costs money. That costs a lot of money, actually.
The city of Revelstoke got $500,000 from the Provincial Rural Economic Diversification and Infrastructure Program. Ingrid Braun is the city's director of community economic development. In an email, she said the city requested these funds from the province for the development of lands adjacent to Oscar Street. $100,000 of that money went to the Housing Society for capacity building, Braun said. Michael Brooks Hill is the co-chair of the Housing Society.
You know, the city's doing a land inventory, and they want to do a master plan for this large chunk of land behind the ambulance station, Humbert Street, Oscar Street, depending on what you're talking about. They've indicated that they would likely, staff have indicated at least that they would likely support leasing a chunk of land here. Obviously, it has to go through council and they make the final decision, but all signs are pointing to the fact that it's a good site for the project and would be approved, but we can't jump the gun and say it will happen.
In her email, Braun said the remaining $400,000 from the province would go towards a master plan for Oscar Street for housing, recreation, and other potential investment-ready purposes. For survey, design, and engineering costs, preliminary site planning, and provision of in-ground servicing, including water, sewer, and electrical. When asked if the Housing Society would have to wait for the master plan to be finished before they could go ahead with their housing development, Braun said those lots would be separated off. They would be serviced to enable the Housing Society to pursue additional funding to support development of further housing units.
It's going to be more two-bedroom units, and we're debating on a three-bedroom, but we're gearing it more towards families this time around.
And do you have any idea how many units it should be?
21 to 22 units.
Ultimately, this money should help the society develop housing more quickly.
There is funding available for planning for these types of surveys and architecture drawings, but you have to put together a proposal, apply for funding for that, receive the funding. And so in terms of doing things quickly, actually having the money up front to pay for these costs makes the whole process go much faster.
And is this $100,000 enough for the development process for this project?
I hope so.
It's not. Is it spent yet?
It's checks have started to go out, yes. It should be enough to cover it. And like Mike said, that there are other options out there that we have started applying for, but those take months. I mean, months to go through. And that's also time on our end as well to apply for all the capital funding. And there's always the off chance we don't get it. And then we're back to square one. We're waiting. And if you look at the time between the builds, it was 2010 for the first, 2016, 2022 for this one. So that was a 6-year gap. And we don't have 6 years to wait for the next build.
Wolf said she doesn't have a timeline for when the houses will be finished because they don't have money for construction yet. They plan on submitting an application for construction funding this summer, Wolf said, saying that the money from the city went towards this application. I'm Megan Dooling.
Hi, I'm Kareem Mosna in Kingston, Ontario. You are tuned to Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories online at canada-info.ca and follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI.
Theatre Quadra is staging its most ambitious project ever. It will be taking on Chicago the Musical. Theatre Quadra began as an amateur theater group in 2011. It has staged 29 productions, making Chicago its 30th show. Over 70 people are involved in Theatre Quadra's staging of Chicago the Musical this spring. Linda Lolliker is the treasurer of Theatre Quadra, a steering committee of the Quadra Island Recreation Society. She's the one who gave the go-ahead to stage a Chicago the Musical. Lolliker is helping out with costumes, and she's also an assistant producer. Heidi Ridgway is managing the roles of producer, director, and choreographer of the musical, and things are going great. The three scheduled performances are nearly all sold out. Quite an accomplishment for this theater, nested on one of the largest of the Discovery Islands, with a population of only 2,600 people. The island is located in the Salish Sea, just between Vancouver and the British Columbia mainland. Linda Lolliker and Heidi Ridgway talk about the relevance of Chicago, the musical, with Craig Osoba on Cortes Island, British Columbia.
We were inspired by Heidi Ridgway, mostly. She's been a valuable and committed member of Theatre Quadra for years and has been in many performances along with directing and producing the Rocky Horror Picture Show back in 2015. And she pitched the idea to our steering committee, which is a steering committee of the Quadra Island Recreational Society. And we said, she had such a good track record, we said, you betcha, Heidi, when you're ready.
Great. Now, what are both of your roles with Theatre Quadra and in this particular production?
I am the assistant producer. My role has been shared with another person because of how much work it is. But my role with this year is with the steering committee. As the I've been the chair and the treasurer for quite a few years, and I'm doing a bit of costuming and a bit of everything.
And how about for you, Heidi?
I am directing, producing, choreographing, and I think I'm actually going to dance in a couple of numbers as well, just to fully round out the whole experience.
Oh, my. Now, would it be safe to say that this is the most ambitious production ever staged by Theater Quadra in terms of the cast size and how elaborate all these scenes are with all the dance numbers?
Definitely, I would agree 100%. It is the most elaborate. The only thing that's even come close was in 2011 when Mamma Mia was staged here on Quadra, and certainly was a very big cast and musical numbers, but not the choreography.
And what do you see, either Heidi or Linda, about the biggest challenges? And perhaps both of you would care to chime in on that.
For me, as a choreographer and director, the biggest challenge has been trying to fit everybody on stage and trying to take numbers that are normally choreographed with six men and turn it into 17 females and two guys. So it is. I've made it more complicated than it had to be so that we could include more people in the production and have a more inclusive experience for everybody. And as well for dancers of all levels of experience. We have absolute novices that have never been on stage before to people who are triple threat veteran pros almost.
Wow. And how many people are actually involved in the entire production?
There's almost 70 people altogether. The cast right now is 28, and then there's a crew of about 30 people as well.
For those who may not know, the whole theme of the Chicago the Musical is that it takes place in the Roaring Twenties, and I guess there are two accused murderesses who are vying for the attention of their described as charismatic lawyer. I'm just curious about what drew you to that actual theme or that sort of a plot in a theater production.
Yeah, it wasn't the theme. So the thing that you may or may not know about, Chicago was a readaptation. It was a musical adaptation of a play called Chicago that was basically a dark satire about the corruption of America and the Chicago specifically at the time and the court system. But it is written, directed, and choreographed by one of my all-time favorites, which is Bob Fosse, who's a very stylized, very specific style of dancing. And one of the other things that is so fantastic about this show is that the original people, the original two stars were Chita Rivera and Gwen Verdon, who was Bob Fosse's muse. And Gwen was 50 at the time, and this was back in 1975. And Chita Rivera, who you would know from West Side Story, very famous Broadway star, she was 40 at the time. So these two iconic roles were created for women of any age. And in this day and age, that's a tough thing in Hollywood. So that is one of the things, being an older lady dancer, that really excited me about it. It's also, Bob Fosse loved strong females, and they're both very strong female characters. And I think the message of it all in the end is believe in yourself and go out there and take the world by storm. And those are great qualities. The irony of it all is that it was, the finale song is actually Nowadays. And in one of the lines is in 50 years from now, which is almost now, things are going to change. But the reality is that things are even worse today than they were then in relation to the star criminal, that celebrity criminal that we could all talk about down south and we all see blasted across the news every day. So a kind of comical look on today through the lens of this amazing dancer. So that's one of the other things that I really love about this show. And the irony of that is because it's 50 years ago, they are talking about the Fosse Foundation, because Bob Fosse passed away, are talking about doing a reversion, a remake on Broadway. And when we applied for the royalties, one of their stipulations was is that we were not allowed to do any paid advertising, which, to be really honest, Greg, is why we're talking to you. Even though, to be honest, we've almost sold out our three shows, we were concerned about bringing people in because we weren't allowed to put any ads in. So very interesting concept for community theater and musicals.
I have to say congratulations on the pre-sales. That's amazing. And thank you for pointing out, too, that the original story was written back, I believe, in 1926. And then, as you say, it was turned into a musical in 1975. So, yeah, we're going on 50 years. I'm just curious, too, how long the actual group Theater Quadra has been producing plays for.
So in 2011, there was a grassroots group of people that got together and pulled Mamma Mia out of the bag and performed it on the stage. And prior to that, we'd had in the 80s Quadra Players, but had folded and wasn't active. So Mamma Mia basically drove the heightened interest in the community to get back into theater. And since then, we have performed 29 various different productions, some of which were lip syncs with Cortez Radio. And so, yeah, since then, we have been an active theater group doing everything from pantomime to big musical productions. Thank you to Heidi's driving interest in that concept. We've done Take 10 festivals, and we try to really, it's amateur theater, it's a small community. We try and engage people in stepping out into some of the smaller roles, and we have a very talented community. A band that's performing in Chicago is all local band members. It's just really such a great community that gets involved.
Okay, now just a final question, and that is, what are you hoping that audience members take home after they go to see Theater Quadra's production of Chicago the Musical?
So for me, I want them to walk away, like with any good theater, I want them to laugh, because it's a very funny play. People don't realize it's a musical, but it's very funny. So I want them to laugh, I want them to cry, and I want them to walk away singing all those songs. Because once you hear them, you will never forget them. They are classic, amazing, fantastic songs. The score is phenomenal. And as Linda said, we have a 7-piece live band. Our leads are, yeah, they're all stars. I'm really proud of them.
From my perspective, I witnessed the joy and the sheer pleasure of watching your community members put themselves out there and perform in front of an audience. And the joy of seeing those close friends, family members, and talented people, just to really reflect on that and want to come back and want to get involved and be a part of our theater group.
Wonderful. Heidi Ridgway and Linda Lolliker, thank you both so much, and best of luck with Chicago the Musical.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Greg.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
Queen's University has the Red Dress Art Project exhibited across campus ahead of the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Gender Diverse People on May 5th. Around 50 red dresses are hanging across outdoor and indoor spaces on campus. The Red Dress Project was created by artist Jamie Black. The art exhibit hopes to draw attention to the more than 1,000 missing and murdered Indigenous women across Canada. The project was launched in 2010 in Canada and had its first display in Washington, D.C. in the USA in 2019. Black said the red dress was specifically chosen as the object to symbolize the women who have faced harsh realities. For me, she says, red represents the lifeblood we all carry. Alexandra Fernandez met up with Jamie Black in Kingston, Ontario.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Jamie.
No problem.
So can you tell us about this project and what it focuses on?
Yeah, so the Red Dress Project is an installation art project to draw attention to violence against Indigenous women and girls, and also to just really create a space to gather community and supporters around this cause.
I'd like to ask why a red dress specifically was picked as the object to honor the missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. What is sort of the significance and representation behind the red dress?
I think that red is such a powerful color, and I think different spiritual cultures around the world have used red in ritual and in ceremony for hundreds and hundreds of years, and I think it's really an ancient symbol. And for me, red represents the the lifeblood that we all carry. So it's this interconnection between us all. And using the color red as well is sort of showing the violence of not caring for that lifeblood and that sacred lifeblood that we all carry.
In 2019, the Red Dress Project was first brought to the United States. And can you tell us a little bit more about that, since it is focused on the missing and murdered Indigenous women of Canada, but obviously there are also missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. So can you tell us a little bit about why you brought that project to the USA and how it was received there?
You know, the issue of colonialism, patriarchy, all these systems that actually affect Indigenous women's lives is really, you know, a more than an issue that happens only in Canada. It happens all over the world, and it's really something we all need to be addressing. So I think, you know, that in that way, this work really speaks across borders and across lands and really speaks to the, you know, the structures that we live within that allow this, you know, unsafe spaces for women. So yeah, so I was actually really excited to have the work travel to the U.S. And what I've done, like, over the years of having this project, you know, exhibited is really, like, the work has been coming to me, and it's been really amazing, and people have been coming to me and inviting me to really bring this conversation forward. And so, you know, for about 10 years, over 10 years, the work has been traveling all across Canada. And as you said, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago, the work started being, you know, represented in the United States as well. And it was such a powerful thing to have the dresses go up in Washington, because that is really, like, it's like the seat of colonialism in the U.S. And mm-hmm. So it was really, really amazing to see those dresses hold space in the public area right across from the Washington Square, you know?
Yeah.
I think that it was really important that the dresses traveled to that space. And so the Museum of the American Indian invited me to come to the space. And you know, I took on that invite and brought those dresses to that space. And I think it was really important way of starting the conversation and breaking the silence around violence against Indigenous women and girls, not just in Canada, but beyond.
With a lot of things that have sort of come to light, I guess, over the last quite a few years. And, you know, the government of Canada, they put out the 94 calls to action as a form of truth and reconciliation with Indigenous peoples and communities across the country. Can you talk a little bit about the 94 calls to action in terms of if the government is doing enough, if they're doing what they can, or what more is needed from them to support Indigenous communities?
A quote that comes to mind is that, you know, the master's house will not be dismantled with the master's tools. And I really do believe that. And I, you know, I see, you know, government sort of paying homage to wanting to make change, but actually not acting on it. And that's something that's been happening since the beginning of colonialism and that settling of this country, right? And mm-hmm. also in the U.S. So it's not super surprising to me that, you know, the structures that created these problems are unwilling to solve the problems. And I'm not even sure that the structures that created them can solve these problems.
Right.
And I guess my focus as an artist, as an activist, as a community supporter is really, you know, working at the grassroots and turning our focus to what action we can take as, you know, as communities, as individuals, as the public, to actually make change from the ground up. And I feel like that's where sort of my faith and my focus has to be, because, you know, otherwise we do. It's true that we see so much inaction. And then what kind of looks like action is actually just, you know, a way of diverting our attention away from, like, the continued colonial acts that are happening over and over again throughout the country, right? Like, you know, people's lands are still being taken. You know, all of these kind of violences and these, you know, issues that we've dealt with are ongoing. They're not gone. And so oftentimes we'll see, you know, political figures say they're, you know, kind of addressing these things when they're just saying that so that we'll, you know, stop fighting for them. About 4 or 5 years ago, I was working for an inquiry here in Canada, and it was the inquiry into violence against Indigenous women and girls. So that was like a 3-year process where we all went across the country and heard stories from families whose loved ones had gone missing or been murdered. And so those stories were gathered, and groups of women from across Canada were working tirelessly to, you know, transcribe those stories and have those stories in the archive and think about ways in which and reasons why this violence is happening in an effort to kind of make change. That inquiry actually came up with a group of recommendations as well. And I think, you know, over the last 4 years since those recommendations have been released, there's been absolute silence from the media around those recommendations. Even though I think it's, you know, the grassroots is where the power is, I also think it's important that we recognize the recommendations that are being, that are coming from the ground up through these inquiries, right? Mm-hmm. And like respecting and responding to those. And I would really love to see and think it's really the responsibility of institutions and different structures to really take on, really acting on these recommendations from both the TRC and from the inquiry. The recommendations from both the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and from the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit, like those are really amazing resources for, you know, like universities, like, you know, different sector, you know, public sector, to really look at and think about how, you know, the ways that they're working, you know, are affecting others, and to make changes there.
Thank you so much for talking with me about the Redress Project, the calls to action, the national inquiry, and speaking with me about everything today. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And this is what concludes this edition of Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalists this week, Craig Osoba, Megan Dooling, and Alexandra Fernandez, National Editor Maureen McEwen. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassin. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Great to have you with us. Stay tuned to the show that follows. Until next week, we hope. Ciao.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.